They've been calling it Bragate. That is the scandal over underwire bras setting off new metal detectors at a Jackson County jail, keeping many of the lawyers defending clients inside the jail out. Many of these lawyers are public defenders, so between overburdened caseloads and very little discretionary income for things like new wardrobes, having access to clients suddenly contingent on bra choice is a real obstacle to getting the work done. That's why attorneys across the metro have been publicly protesting the new security measure. So that's Bragate in a nutshell. Our newsroom's been covering it and will continue to do so, but it got us thinking about how gender plays out in the legal profession more broadly. I'm Gina Kaufman with a room full of lady lawyers on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Tracy Spradlin, let's start with you because you've been really involved in Bragate. I want to start with your own backstory. You graduated from law school in 2013, and you thought you'd become a public prosecutor, but you ended up going in another direction.
Yes, I started out at the city prosecutor's office and wound up going out on my own, starting my own firm, and all I knew was criminal defense and traffic. So I never saw myself as a criminal defense attorney or a small business owner, and that is how I have wound up, and I don't think I could have seen it any other way now.
So traffic and crime.
Yes.
Give me examples of the kinds of cases you handle and explain a little bit about how you connect with your clients, what it takes to represent them.
Yeah, sure. So I do anything from traffic tickets, you know, people getting speeding tickets, insurance tickets, all the way up to I've had clients that were charged with first degree murder. And most of my clients are not in jail, but the some that are will either be in there from the time they're arrested until we get them in front of a judge, or they might have to spend the entire term up leading up to trial in some sort of jail.
So when you go to the jail to consult with clients, possibly for the first time, how much notice do you typically have?
Well, and that's the thing. Whenever I get hired on cases, it might be suddenly parents are calling because they've just heard that their children have been arrested, or husband, wife found out that somebody was picked up and I need to get down there before they're arraigned or before they have their first court appearance. And I might not have a lot of notice. And additionally, if I get offers from prosecutors, get discovery that's timely, I might need to run that over. And looking at my schedule, I might have to run out the door right then. I might have to run out the door that afternoon, and I would not have time to change or do much prep work to get me over to the jail and ready to see a client.
And so that is relevant to this whole Bragate situation, that you can't plan your undergarments accordingly because you don't know.
Well, and one of the things that I know a lot of people may not be familiar with, especially male listeners, is that I will start my day at 8 a.m. at a municipal court, and I may have night court at a city municipal court that is only part-time, maybe once a month, but they're at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I need a bra that will get me through that entire day and that I feel comfortable and supported and, you know, I feel
it's
like...
It's not a fashion statement.
No, it's not a fashion statement. It is about being able to do my job productively and being able to feel as comfortable as I can when I'm making, you know, decisions that affect my client's future.
How else do you see these new security measures possibly interfering with your work or the work of your female colleagues?
There is a multitude of unintended consequences, I believe, that came out of this universal screening policy. First and foremost, it has created a barrier for our clients' Sixth Amendment constitutional rights to their access to counsel. Like I said earlier, we have to go meet with our clients sometimes on very little notice. And when you delay access to counsel, that's denying them justice. And one of the things that I want to make sure all of the listeners understand with the Jackson County Detention Center, it is a jail. It is not a prison. It is a facility where people are being housed that are pre-adjudication, meaning that they are presumed innocent, and meaning that they have court dates and trials that are looming in which they need to be able to provide assistance to their counsel to aid in their own defense.
So other than this debacle over underwear, are there ways that you feel your gender affects your ability to get your job done? I mean, I'm just speaking very broadly about your experience in the legal profession. Like, is there a sense that you have that being a woman presents obstacles or things that you need to consider that your male counterparts don't have to think about?
Sure. We are seeing studies that are showing that women are graduating law school at an equal rate to males, but we are not seeing them as represented in trials, first chairing trials, in the courtroom,
things
like that.
What does first chairing trials mean?
That means that they are the primary lead counsel. So there may be a secondary counsel that is assisting with questioning witnesses, doing depositions, but they are the train driving that case forward. And we are not seeing women represented still at that same level as males. Now, specifically to criminal defense, it is a very male-dominated field here in the metro area. And there are much fewer female criminal defense attorneys. And I think that that in itself is difficult enough.
Why is that difficult?
It is hard to make your way through. And I think some of the other guests could mirror this. When you can tell your client, I will be in this rural courthouse, and they said, well, how do I know who you are? Because they've hired you over the phone, or, you know, and you can without a doubt say, I'll be the only female attorney there. It will all be male attorneys. You can see me because I will be the only one up there that is a woman. And in some sense, that is empowering to be like, no one else is there doing this like the way that I do it. But it's also sad that I can say, I don't have as many female counterparts, and you do not feel that you are appropriately represented in some of these smaller courthouses or in some of these areas of law as males are.
Do you think that there are situations where a woman who is in some sort of legal trouble in like a criminal law case would fare well to have a woman as her representative?
Oh, sure. And when, especially when you're talking about issues that are sensitive, things that are more personal in nature, it is easier to talk to, you know, someone who resonates with you. Additionally, from trial strategy standpoints, when you have males who are charged with certain crimes, from a jury pool standpoint, they would respect seeing that there is a female attorney that is working with them, seeing that interaction. And that's something that we always are cognizant of, is how are we coming off? How is my client? How am I coming off to the trier of fact, whether that's a judge or a jury? But when you have people that are charged with heinous or violent crimes and you can see them sitting next to their female attorney who is engaging them, they are acting appropriately, things like that. If you have more female representation, you can see that interaction a lot more.
So we're looking to have this conversation, not just with our guests in the studio, but with you out there if you are also a woman and a lawyer. We want your stories and your observations about how inclusive the profession is or is not. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also tweet. We are at KCURCST. Dana Tippin Cutler is also with us. She is kind of a celebrity lawyer here in Kansas City. She's been in the field of law for a long time. Not only that, but she's working at a firm that was founded by her father, so she is a second-generation lawyer. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Great.
Do you relate to what you're hearing from Tracy?
I am. I've been practicing law 30 years as of August 1st of this year, and while many things have changed, some of the very things that she's talking about are things that I experienced as a new lawyer, particularly going out into the rural areas and doing civil defense. I don't do criminal, but the same thing. If my client lived out in a rural area, that might be the first time I would see them at a hearing. And they're like, well, how will I know you? And I'm going to be not only the only female, but the only, probably the only person of color in the courtroom. And so to hear a younger, much younger attorney say that she's still experiencing that when she goes out state is somewhat disheartening. Yes.
Have women's experiences working in law in Kansas City changed over the years that you've witnessed or experienced?
There has been positive change. You know, we have, when I started practicing, we had one female judge at the circuit level. That was Judge Messina. She's recently retired. Awesome woman, attorney, and judge. We now have a bench that many women, women of color, serve on the bench. So that's an awesome change. That's the right way to go. But then you have things like Bragate going on, and you think, really? Is this what we're doing in 2019? And so while we're seeing positive movement, we're seeing women become partners in firms, we have women heading firms, but we're still, that's one or two, as opposed to the number of firms that we have in the city. So are we doing better? Yes. Could we do better? Absolutely.
When you talk about something like women becoming partners in their firms, what do you think accounts for a positive change like that one?
Well, I think when you see women, if you're a young attorney or are going to law school, and you can see in firms that women are being promoted, that they have real opportunity to be first chair attorneys, it inspires them to go into the profession and grow it even more so. But our concern, I think, is how few those numbers are. And it takes a special firm to figure that out clearly, because we have so many firms that don't have women. We have firms that don't have women at all, except as secretaries or paralegals.
What is there to figure out, though, especially with women graduating from law school in equal numbers to men?
One of the startling statistics is that after 7 to 10 years of practice, 60% of women in law firms leave their firms. That is a startling statistic, because if you think about all that you go through to go to law school, pass the bar, get in a firm, and then 6 to 7 years.
I don't want to think about that. It sounds so hard.
Right. 6 to 7 years after that, you're no longer wanting to do this. There is something for firms to figure out.
What do you think it might be, though?
Culture. Creating a place where you don't have to feel slighted if you are a mom, if you're wanting to have outside interest, if you are supporting things that are near and dear to your heart. Having a firm where that culture is promoted and you're allowed to be, instead of trying to fit women into the mold that has been set by men who have been there for years. That's what they need to figure out.
Tracy, jump back in here.
Well, and I want to toot Dana's horn a little bit, because I think also seeing women in these positions, Dana is recently our last Missouri Bar president. And so being able to see a woman and a woman of color in that role and seeing them do things like take charge of these organizations and be a representative, they can make change from the inside. We, Dana was also part of a program that I was in the Association for Women Lawyers, where we had a mentoring group. And the idea that was started was so more seasoned female attorneys could be paired up with younger attorneys or attorneys that have been practicing for less periods of time, because we might not get that support in the firms that we're in.
Can you give me an example of something that having a mentor taught you or gave you some sort of boost in, whether it's your own understanding of what you would be facing or just someone there cheering you on? Like, in what way did having that mentor help you?
So, sure. Speaking of that organization, my very first mentor that I was paired up with, and the way it's called the Denise Henning Connections Program, and it honors Denise Henning, who has passed away, but this was really her brainchild. It's 5 years, and there are 5 mentors, and there are 5 mentees, and each year you rotate with a different, you're matched up with a different mentee and mentor, and you do one-on-one, but you also do group activities. And we have celebrated, we just had our 10-year anniversary of that, and I recently graduated, and graduating out of it, I feel old, but I also miss that camaraderie of just being around women who are so powerful and who are trying to do so much to change the lives of their clients or the community. But my very first mentor was named Aubrey Gann Redman, and she was a solo practitioner, and this is right after I opened my own firm. And she does probate litigation and now is one of the foremost medical marijuana attorneys in the state and is championing kind of that movement. But she just took me out and just started explaining things to me. I didn't know how to run a business. I didn't know. I had never taken a deposition. One of the best things she did for me was just helping me get clients and teaching me how to do that. Because, you know, the sad fact is all we have to sell is our time in this profession. And I am a kind of a used car salesman in that I need to get business and bring business in. And I had no idea how to do that. And I had no idea how to toot my own horn or how to build myself up to people and just how to give that elevator speech. And that's one of the things that you just need to know. And you don't really get that when you go to a firm.
Do you think not knowing that had a gender piece to it?
It is statistically harder for women to talk about themselves than it is for men. It is much easier in that realm for men to say what they have accomplished or what they're doing, and women have a harder time, and I don't know why. I don't know if Dana wants to step in, but
you know, I work in my family's firm, so I've learned how to eat what I kill.
What do you mean?
Well, if you don't, it's a hunter type thing. We are hunting for clients. So if you don't go out there and get the clients, you can't feed your family and pay your bills, which is, you know, what we're talking about here is learning how to do that. And it is hard for women to, you know, say, I'm good at what I do. I'm effective. I will be good counsel for you. I think it's because we're taught this whole thing of being modest and humble, and that there's a place for that.
Do you think there's also a piece of it that you hear how people talk about women who aren't being what they perceive as modest?
Well,
right.
Yes.
That's the whole thing is that, you know, there are certain words and names that women are called if they're seen as ambitious and aggressive.
Bulldog.
That's one of them.
Some of them
we
may not say.
And, yeah. And so you have to have this, you know, you have to figure out that place where you can be your best self and talk about your best self without bringing up these other pieces that are negative. And I don't think men worry about that at all.
And one of the other parts that we're leaving out is that we are in an adversarial business.
Exactly.
There is a V on each side of the names on our cases, and that means we're versus. And so there's this perception that we're against each other or that we're fighting with each other, when really, you know, whenever you can manage that, I can have cases against prosecutors who are some very good friends of mine, and we are able to separate that, but not everyone is able to do that. And we are charged with zealously representing our clients. And in order to do that, we need to fight for our clients in such a way that we are advocating for them, but not burning bridges and creating this, you know, dumpster fire with our relationships in the community. But that is hard, because then you have to also rely on those people to show you how to do things, to mentor you, to, you know, help you be a better attorney.
And in that versus situation, there are men who will take that opportunity and feel like they can bully you, you know. And I am in the middle of a matter right now, and I felt like the attorney's entire approach with me was very bullying and very aggressive, and so unnecessarily so. And I guess because I've been out here a long time, and at this point, I am who I am. And I wrote him this letter and said, hey, you know how you feel about my client. I know that you and your client think my client stinks. We don't share that impression. But what I don't need is, and I laid out, you know, I was like, I think that attorneys can disagree without being disagreeable. Can we bring the tone down? And the next letter I got from him was markedly better.
You know, Dana, you've held a lot of leadership positions. That's come up. Are the issues that women face in this profession, the legal profession, being addressed within, like, at the leadership level, at the highest leadership levels? Are there strategies around it?
Yes. I am so proud of the Missouri Bar. The Missouri Bar is celebrating 75 years this year. And the Board of Governors, we have a gender and justice committee. They have make it a priority to study strategies, training, to keep up with what's going on in the profession. And so we definitely are attuned to this issue. And just not only that issue, but issues of race, gender, sexual orientation.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about women working in the legal profession inspired by the recent scandal known as Bragate. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. When we return, a co-chair of the Missouri Bar's Supreme Court Joint Commission on Women in the Legal Profession weighs in from St. Louis. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Central Standard this morning on KCUR 89.3 and for making us Kansas City's number one station in the mornings. Coming up today on Here and Now, actress and rapper Awkwafina is well known for her comedic roles in Crazy Rich Asians and more, and she takes a dramatic turn in the new movie The Farewell. We talk with her on Here and Now between noon and 2 on KCUR 89.3. KCUR is supported by the Harem and Jewel series, presenting its 55th season that includes sopranos Angela Giorgiou and Nadine Sierra and mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato. The complete season is online at hjseries.org. And the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where Kansas residents can qualify for in-state tuition. Information is online at umkc.edu/kansasrate.
Summer is the best time to get out and explore, and KCUR is here to help. Now through Labor Day, get a creative Kansas City adventure emailed each week. Sign up at kcur.org/summer.
76 degrees and mostly sunny right now in Kansas City. It's sunny and 77 in Parkville. Let's get back now to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about women in law. Is the legal profession welcoming for women, or do they face obstacles to advancing in the field or getting their work done that their male colleagues don't? I've been talking with two women who are lawyers in Kansas City, and we're going to shortly bring in a guest, well, we're going to bring her in right now, from St. Louis, because she has been researching this very thing. Megan Phillips is co-chair of the Missouri Bar Supreme Court Joint Commission on Women in the Legal Profession. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
So I should say you are a lawyer also.
Yes.
You've said that your career trajectory looks like an ampersand.
That's right.
Explain that.
Well, there have been several iterations of my career. After law school, I moved to Paris and practiced for a New York firm there for a couple of years, came back to Missouri and landed in St. Louis doing corporate and transactional work for a large law firm here. Got my loans paid off and decided that corporate law and big law was just not a good fit for my interests and skill sets. Made a lot of good friends and kept them, but went into public service. Worked in domestic violence for a few years.
You know, I just want to acknowledge the story that you're kind of telling is fitting right in with the statistics that Dana shared about how long women stay with their firms.
Yes, I didn't stay even the 7 to 10 years that Dana was talking about. And I actually took a note while she was speaking about that because you had asked, Gina, why do women leave? They leave for a lot of reasons. I mean, they're all wrapped up in implicit bias, but a lot of it is about being valued or being undervalued specifically, and that that takes a lot of forms, credit allocation, and when it boils down to it, money. I mean, there's still a large pay gap, and compensation structures and formulas in law firms do not help women. And so, yeah, they decide if they're not going to be valued in a firm, go out and hang a shingle or go into government, do something else. So I think that factors into the attrition rates for law firms, which is very
but
costly
maybe not
to the firms.
Professional soccer, as we've heard. Can you tell me more about, though, the pay issue, which is kind of what I'm alluding to with women's soccer?
Right. It's a great time to be talking about this. Yes. Women still make only about, well, depends on what's a tranche of the legal profession, anywhere from 70% to 80% of what men make. That pay gap is higher at the partner level just because of how compensation formulas work and how credit is allocated within law firms and how business is inherited, how clients are inherited.
When you say how credit is allocated, forgive me, but I don't quite understand that.
Sure. So in most private law firms, credit, when a client comes in the door and revenue is generated from that client, usually it is the, it's called the first touch rule. The first person who brings that client in the door gets that credit allocation and a huge, you know, percentage of the revenue from that business. And that's usually detrimental to women because those are usually men. And what progressive law firms are doing now is cutting the pie into more pieces. There are some great firms in Kansas City doing this to value and reward other types of contributions to a client file.
Other than, like, snagging the client.
Exactly.
Why are men doing most of the snagging of clients?
Well, they've been doing it since forever. That's been what they do. Women have been in the profession a long time now, decades, but are still not rising to those levels of power, being in the room for a pitch, having access to opportunities to drum up business. You know, guys still go to strip clubs. A lot gets done on a golf course and places where women aren't necessarily always invited to go along to make rain.
And then, and just to piggyback on that, these huge clients that have been there forever, Fortune 100 companies, mm-hmm. They already have somebody, and that somebody probably is not female. When that attorney retires, he gets to decide who inherits that work.
Right.
Well, he's going to give it to somebody he's been working with, which is more likely than not someone who looked just like him.
Mm-hmm.
And so women, minorities, are left out of that opportunity to have these massive or important clients in firms, and that's how compensation's decided.
And you know, Dana, I want to say you've mentioned a couple of times race and other kinds of status, what you might in like an HR world call protected status or something like that. But like, can you talk a little bit about how that piece of it has affected your career?
You know, I've been fortunate because I worked in a firm where everybody looked like me, at least in terms of race. And so it was never an issue at home, if you will, but it has been an issue in the courtroom. It has been an issue in getting clients, you know, just like I said, going in outstate. And we do mostly insurance defense work, so I would be representing an insurance company. And I can't tell you how many times a judge in a rural area would presume I was the plaintiff or the actual litigant or representing that person. And I would say, no, I'm representing blah, blah insurance company. And they would go, what? I mean, they would double check with me, like, are you sure you're representing such and such an insurance company? Like, I wouldn't know that. I've had arguments that I made and the judge would, you know, say, well, that doesn't make sense. And then my co-defense counsel, a gentleman, a white male, would make virtually the same argument. And he's like, that's, you know, I understand exactly what you're saying. I had one incident where it was so clear what happened. Counsel apologized to me and said, I am so sorry. That really stank. I'm so sorry. So, yeah, those issues, and I don't know how much of it was my gender or my race or the combination, but those things still happen, and you suck it up, and it makes me a stronger, better attorney.
Well, I want to get back to Megan and the Supreme Court Joint Commission on Women in the Legal Profession. What is that? And I feel like maybe the conversation thus far is the answer to this next one, but why does it exist?
So the Joint Commission on Women in the Profession is a body of 20 lawyers, half appointed by the Missouri Bar and half appointed by the Missouri Supreme Court. And we're sort of version 10.0 of the Gender Injustice Task Force of the 90s that Dana was talking about. And our mission is to just assess the status of women lawyers, identify barriers to their advancement, and do what we can on a statewide level to secure women's full and equal participation in the legal profession. So our work is generally behind the scenes and quiet, and we try to collaborate with stakeholders like the bar, like the Supreme Court, other governmental entities, and private local bars to address issues that create barriers to women lawyers. And I can give you a few examples
yes,
if you're interested.
Yes, please do. Because you guys do a lot of studies that are super fascinating.
There's a lot of research out there. We have not invented any wheels. There are plenty of resources for statistics and studies and toolkits and best practices through the ABA Commission on Women, the National Association for Women Lawyers, lots of others. But we have tried to pull some of that information and provide it to policymakers with recommendations for certain improvements in the profession. For example, we worked with the Women's Foundation here in Kansas City. They also provided us with some of their excellent research, and we're able to provide that to the Missouri Supreme Court to help them devise a policy for paid parental leave for all employees of the Missouri judiciary. And that leave policy was passed last year, so we're proud of that. It helps not only women lawyers, but all parents working for state government in the judiciary. Another thing we did recently was to provide information and recommendations to the Supreme Court about lactation accommodation in state courthouses because women need to pump when they come back from maternity leave. And there was no place to do that in most court facilities. And the Supreme Court passed an operating rule that benefits all employees of the judiciary that is in compliance with the Fair Labor Standard Act that provides lactation accommodation to nursing mothers. Officially, that only benefits the employees, but now that courts are being required to create facilities, you know, create a space in the courthouse for employees, we're hopeful that those facilities will also be made available to women lawyers, you know, who appear for court back from maternity leave on a request basis. So the commission may be interested to know from your listeners where those facilities have been created already, what courthouses might need some help to do so. But we think that that's a big benefit because it's hard to come back from maternity leave and be nursing and then be in court and have to go pump in your car or in a public restroom. And a lot of women have been doing that for decades. Mm-hmm. So that was a good one. We've hosted some symposiums featuring national experts on women's advancement and implicit bias. We had a luncheon for managing partners in Kansas City.
But what are some of the things that you have learned about the conditions that women who are lawyers work within and how implicit bias? I mean, we've heard a lot of reference to implicit bias, but how specifically do you see that affecting the work and life of women who are right. lawyers?
Like Dana says, the more, like she said, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, I think I still hear stories from our constituents of things like being interrupted in meetings or having ideas stolen, or somebody thinks you're the court reporter or the paralegal, or being asked to fetch coffee or to take notes in a meeting. These are partners, women partners, who have had these experiences.
Always the secretary at the meeting. Why don't you take those notes?
Right. Being overlooked for big assignments because somebody assumes that you're not committed because you're a mom or don't want to travel. Being intimidated or bullied for trying to take credit for a client that one deserves to claim. Lots of examples like that, not even to talk about the dress code. You know, we have also...
No, do talk about the dress code because it's more than just... Bragate has raised some awareness around the specific example of underwire bras, but it seems like the how to dress question is bigger than that.
Yes, and the commission, it's funny because...
But can you explain what it is?
Explain what is?
What the how to dress question is. How else is attire kind of an issue for women?
Well, I can give you an example.
Sure.
You know, I did a jury trial with my now law partner, and whenever we went back to talk to the jury afterwards, you know, they wanted to talk to the male attorneys about the legal arguments, but then they wanted to talk to me about my outfit or things like that, or you know. And then I'll be in court, and this is what I wanted to say earlier on the implicit bias. I will be addressed. There's a local rule about addressing attorneys as Mr. or Mrs. Counselor, you know, and the male counterpart on the other side of my case will be Mr. Smith or Mr., you know, and then they'll say, what do you think about that, Tracy? And it can be a nice, like, oh, you're familiar with me, that's nice. But then it also, you leave and you're like, are they calling me Tracy because they don't feel that I'm on the same level as Mr. Smith or Mr., you know, and I'll get other attorneys, male attorneys, will say, well, you're too pretty or you're too young or you're, you know, why are you an attorney, you know? And I don't understand. They would never say that to a male, you know. And I'm like, what else am I supposed to be doing? Making a sandwich, you know? But yeah, you get unfairly, whenever we do a jury trial, we have to consider so much what we're wearing because that can be all that juries or the trier of fact will focus on. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be distracting. And we have entire Facebook groups of women associated, you know, where we will talk about stuff like that. Can I wear this to court? Can I wear this to my jury trial? Or is it too flashy? Are these floral prints too, you know? And it sounds petty, but it can affect the way it's that your real. Client's viewed.
I don't wear jewelry. I don't wear my wedding set. I wear just a plain gold band. I don't wear, you know, I wear just little dots for earrings. As plain as possible, so your outfit is not the top conversation. And you're right. I mean, I've tried cases with my husband and my dad, and they'll talk about that, you know, whatever the legal issues, but they'll talk, you were so nice. I really liked how you know, and it has nothing to do with legal set.
With the substance.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Sarah. Sarah's calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, and I'm a colleague and friend of Tracy. And
hi, also Sarah.
Practice, and also practice criminal defense, mainly in Jackson County, but in a two-woman law firm, and spend a lot of time in the Jackson County Jail, as well as Clay County and some of the surrounding municipalities. And I just finished a jury trial out in eastern Jackson County. And again, just there's an extra layer when it comes to trial prep, that when you are preparing to present arguments or questions to a jury or to a witness, I feel like there are things I want to say and I have to reshape how I say them because of how it will come off if I'm a woman saying it.
Can you give an example? I know that if this is a common occurrence, it might be hard to pull one out of the hat right now, but I am curious.
Well, I'll tell you, we do, like I said, across the board criminal defense, including individuals who are charged with sex offenses. And in a recent trial, we had to spend a lot of our time, a majority of our time during jury selection, talking about victim shaming. The case was a he said, she said. And so to, as Tracy mentioned, zealously advocate for our client, our defense was to be critical of the accuser, and that happened to be a woman who claimed that she was sexually assaulted. And we had to go through an extensive explanation about, you know, as women and the Me Too movement, we feel empowered, but as criminal defense attorneys whose clients are presumed innocent until proven guilty, it's difficult. And even though we went through all of that, still the prosecutor in his very last closing argument rebuttal said, you know, all they're doing is victim blaming and victim shaming. And so that's a hard thing to combat.
Well, Sarah, thank you for that call. Megan, jump back in here. You know, what do you think is the crux of the work that remains to be done to level the playing field for women in law?
Wow, that's a tall order.
If you could do that in about 30 seconds, that'd be great.
Sure. You know, the commission will keep doing what it's doing. We have conducted a first chair study, and we'll issue a report on that. We're trying to move the needle with little issues as they come to us. And generally, it's our constituents who bring something to our attention and say, hey, this is a problem. I can't pump in a courthouse. Can you do anything about that? And so there's that. The pay equity issue is the one that is on everyone's mind. And we, as a, you know, public body, can't really stick our noses into the affairs of private law firms, but we can certainly continue to educate women and leaders to all do everyone's part to continue to make change.
Megan Phillips, thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
and Dana Tippin Cutler, Tracy Spradlin, Kansas City attorneys. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be back in a minute with something entirely different on KCUR's Central Standard.
Coming up this morning at 11 on KCUR.
It's a familiar question in Kansas City. Do teens here have a place to gather, hang out, and stay out of trouble? On the next Up to Date, why a summer without Cinemark on the Plaza has us asking again. Join us.
Join us for that coming up in 15 minutes on KCUR's Up to Date. KCUR is supported by Harrah's Voodoo Lounge, presenting Al DiMeola on September 6th in his past, present, and future Music of DiMeola, Piazzolla, and the Beatles U.S. Fall Tour. Tickets will be available tomorrow at 10 at Ticketmaster.com/VoodooKC. It's 10:46, 78 degrees in Kansas City. I'm Linda Scher. Let's get back to Central Standard on KCUR.
The University of Missouri has a Center for Body Image Research and Policy. Fascinating, right? The director says she's found that 3D images of young women can be used to help them learn the skill of body appreciation, which might in turn improve mental health. The idea is to get participants to think about their bodies without regard to size or weight. The director of the center who conducted that study is Virginia Ramsayer Winter, assistant professor in the School of Social Work. She's with us now on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning.
Why does this center exist? Like, what is its mission?
Sure. So at the Center for Body Image Research and Policy, our primary goal is to produce innovative, rigorous, high quality research that helps us understand how body image relates to health and improves body image, and thereby improving health. And also, as our name suggests, it's our goal to move into policy research in the coming years, as we cannot significantly improve body image by only addressing it at the individual or family level. It really requires systemic change. So, for example, it's perfectly legal to discriminate against people based on their body size in most states in the US. So a company could fire somebody in a large body just because they're fat, even if they do their job as well or even better than somebody in a smaller body. So I think these injustices need to be addressed in order to improve body image and health. So in addition to our intervention research, we'll be moving more toward policy work in the near future.
How do you define body appreciation?
So body appreciation is really appreciating your body for all that it does for you, all that it is. So it's appreciating your appearance, but also the body's function. It is the ability to reject cultural ideals for appearance.
What is this recent study about? How did it work? It's super fascinating to me to think that by showing people images of themselves and kind of reframing what it is you're focusing on, that you could see some change. How did you conduct the study, first of all?
Sure. So, you know, I got this idea for this 3D intervention study when I read a study where researchers had professional dancers map their pain onto their avatar. I thought that was really fascinating and wondered what it would look like if we could map our body image onto our avatar. And at the same time that I was reading the study, the body image research field was expanding to show that if we can move focus away from appearance and toward function, we can significantly improve individual body image. So with those things in mind, we developed an intervention called 3D body appreciation mapping, or 3D BAM, as we call it, where participants were scanned in a 3D scanner, which uses digital photography technology and takes literally 3 seconds. We took the data from the scans to create avatars. So then the participants would come back for the intervention, where they were asked to digitally paint their avatars based on a series of statements, such as, paint the parts of your body you appreciate for their utility, the things they do for you, or paint the parts of your body you appreciate for their role in your friendship. And when participants painted their avatars, they could rotate and flip them as much as they wanted, so they could paint the bottom of their feet or their back, the top of their head if they wanted to. We used a different color for each of the statements, which resulted in very beautiful avatars at the end of the intervention.
And then, so I guess I want to make sure I understand this. You would say something like, paint the parts of your body that you appreciate for what they do in a friendship. For example, what parts of the body typically get kind of selected for something like that?
Sure. You know, participants a lot of times would comment as they were painting their avatars, which was fascinating. And they would say things like, you know what, I am so grateful that I can give my best friend a hug. So they might paint their arms for that reason. Or sometimes they would paint their heads and indicate that they were actually painting their brains because they appreciate being able to converse with their best friend.
Wow. So what other kinds of life skills came back to body parts through this, other than sort of the ability to be a friend? What are some other examples?
Sure. We talked about painting parts of body for their role in your romantic relationships, for utility, and those sorts of things.
How did you measure what changed?
Yeah, so we used a number of validated scales, and ultimately what we found from the intervention is that participants had significantly improved body appreciation immediately after the intervention and 3 months post-intervention. And importantly, we also found that participants with more severe depression scores at baseline had lower depressive symptoms after the intervention and 3 months post-intervention as well.
Like in large enough numbers that you could say that there is a correlation?
Yes, absolutely.
How are people within your field talking about this? This seems huge.
Yeah, we are so excited about it. You know, and I think the field in general is talking a lot about intervention work and talking a lot about moving toward body function and shifting that focus from aesthetics to function. The study is so new and it was just published, so there isn't a ton of chatter about this study in particular yet. But it's been very well received on social media from my colleagues across the world and from individuals as well. People are excited about this. You know, 3D avatars are just becoming ubiquitous. We see them in gaming. I think that eventually we're going to be trying on clothes virtually when we go to, you know, whatever clothing website. And so there's opportunities to kind of infiltrate those spaces with some of this work. So we're excited about that.
It is interesting that we don't think about, like, as a culture, appreciating our bodies for what they actually do until we're sick. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's true.
Like, all I want to be able to do right now is, like, breathe normally. That's a thing you would say if you have a cold. But then you breathe normally and you're like, yeah, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great example.
But what does that have to do with body image?
What does what have to do with body image?
That whole way that we think about our bodies.
Sure. So when we can think about our bodies for what they do for us, we think less about how they appear to us. So if we shift this focus, and instead of thinking, gosh, I wish my thighs were smaller, they're so fat, or whatever body part, instead focus on, I'm so grateful that my legs carried me into my office today and that I was able to walk into the office building. Or I may not appreciate the size of my stomach or the stretch marks that I have, but I was able to carry a child. That is a big deal. If we can shift that focus away, we see away from appearance, we see improved body image, which has pretty big implications for health. And we see implications for, you know, in this study, we just looked at depression, but we see implications for physical, mental, sexual health, and relationship health.
We haven't gotten into the details of how you measured the progress. You mentioned that there were a lot of measures, but I can only guess that witnessing a human being come to appreciate, like, the vessel that they are in and make some sort of progress in that respect has to be an emotional thing to witness.
It is, absolutely. And we did some qualitative interviews with a small subsample of the participants after the intervention, and it was so rewarding to hear them talk about things like, I have never thought of my body in this way. I was walking to class the other day and I realized that I appreciated that I could walk to class, or, you know, whatever the case may be. They gave a number of really specific examples, and hearing them talk about that, it is emotional and it is incredibly rewarding.
How do you imagine this whole idea being implemented? I mean, especially your findings in various contexts, in the mental health context, in the social work context, maybe even in schools. I was thinking about those weird tests when you're in school. I don't know if schools still do this, where people grab your arm fat with plastic pincher thingies. Like, could they also do the 3D scanner thing that day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, why not? You know, so our next step for the study is we've submitted a funding proposal to the National Institute of Mental Health. And our plan is to move it into the community with the ultimate goal of providing enough evidence so this can be used in places like community mental health centers and schools, like you say. So the scanner that we used is quite expensive, but it doesn't have to be. You can buy 3D body scanners or 3D scanners that attach to an iPod for just a few $100s. So that might be an affordable cost for a community mental health center to be able to implement this intervention. You know, I'm in conversations with an eating disorder treatment center. This hasn't been tested in a clinical population, but it might be another tool that they can use with eating disorder patients to help them shift their focus away from size and appearance.
It is interesting to me, too, to think about cases where there is a medical reason why a person might want to consider weight loss or weight gain, that it could shift that conversation away from being about how a person looks and being about increasing a function, just sort of the same way, like if you sprain an ankle and go to physical therapy or something, that you'd be like, I'm doing this to walk again, you know?
Sure. Yeah. It's very empowering to, you know, to lose weight for a health reason. Let's say you aren't able to walk up the stairs wherever you're going, and you lose weight and you focus on, wow, I can walk up the stairs. Like, I really appreciate that about my body, as opposed to, I'm going to focus on the scale and the numbers. What we need to focus on is how we feel and what our body can do for us.
What do you think is the significance of body image in a person's life? Because I think it could be easy for some people to dismiss it as a minor thing, but I suspect that that is not how you see it.
It's not how I see it, and it's not what I hear from other people. Anytime we talk about our work at the center, we receive messages about personal experiences. This is so salient for most people, men, women, marginalized communities. This is an important issue. People talk about how they struggle with this anytime we talk about our work. And we know that it relates to depression, anxiety, eating disorders. Eating disorders are the deadliest mental illness. And body image is a significant predictor of eating disorders. It relates to quality of romantic relationships, the sexual behaviors somebody engages in. So this is actually a very salient issue for most people.
Our time is up, but Ginny Ramsayer-Winter, head of MU's Center for Body Image Research and Policy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
The center's just done a study on body appreciation using 3D imagery and information about how different parts of the body actually work and what they do for us. If you want to hear anything you missed from that conversation or the earlier discussion about women in the legal profession, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. The audio from today's show will be there by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also talk to us on Twitter. We're at @KCURCST. Tomorrow is a food show. We're visiting an orchard at peak season for berries and peaches, and we'll be putting out a call for the best restaurant patios in town. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.